Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, how slavery is taught in schools across the country. There are growing conversations around this, given that 2019 marks the 400th anniversary of the beginning of American slavery. This landmark year has raised many questions, among them, what's in our textbooks and curriculum guidelines, and what should be there? How do New Hampshire teachers conduct classroom discussions when most of them are white? And in our country's fraught political atmosphere these days, how do educators talk about slavery's history in connection with today's news? Let's bring you into our conversation. What did you learn about slavery in school, and how else did you learn about it outside of the classroom? We'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests for the hour. With me in studio, Gerrianne Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire and Director of the Harriet Wilson Project. Gerrianne, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us from New York City, Nikita Stewart, reporter for the New York Times. She wrote, "Why Can't We Teach Slavery Right in American Schools?" for the 1619 Project with the Times. That's a reporting project about slavery in America 400 years after it began. And Nikita, a big welcome to you, too. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Nikita, to you first, just broadly, and then we'll definitely get into details throughout the hour. But what's missing from your average American public education when it comes to this topic?
We have to start at the beginning. You know, when we're children, we learn about our founding fathers. We learn about George Washington. We learn about Thomas Jefferson. We learn about all of these great men. But we don't learn about their stances, their views on enslavement that helped to shape this country. So I believe that is what's missing. We have to start at the beginning and not when we get to the Civil War.
So that's how slavery is usually presented, Nikita. It's sort of, you know, 15, 20 years before the Civil War and 10 years after the Civil War. That's kind of that isolated chunk. You're saying start at the beginning and go all the way to the present day.
Yes. You know, in my essay that I wrote for the New York Times, I talked to lots of folks, but I remember talking specifically to Hassan Jeffries, and he spoke to me about his daughter who was elementary school aged, coming to him with her assignment to give some fun facts about George Washington. She was like, "Oh, he loved rabbits. He owned rabbits." And he said, "Yes, he owned rabbits. He also owned people." And that, you know, I guess could be kind of shocking for children. But if we don't learn to teach them in a way that is sensitive and age appropriate, we're never going to get past this discussion that we're having now.
You know, Gerrianne, this fits in perfectly to the work that you're doing. You've talked a lot about reminding Northerners that slavery was present here right from the beginning.
Absolutely. So we had the first enslaved person in recorded in Portsmouth being from 1645. And so we have that story. And that's, I want to remind people that that's what we have recorded. You know, there could have been somebody else before, an enslaved person before, but that was a case that actually went up. The man that was captured and brought to Portsmouth in 1645 was captured on a Sunday, the day of the Sabbath. So they were, you're not supposed to, not because he was captured and enslaved, but because he was, the enslavers did it on a Sunday. So that became the news in the court. So that's why we have that record. But without that, we wouldn't have had that. Yeah.
Do you see what Nikita talks about, that slavery in general in our schools here in New Hampshire is taught as sort of an important part of a unit concerning the Civil War, but it's not threaded into the whole narrative of our country?
Well, first of all, we talk about slavery as going to Africa to get slaves. We didn't go to Africa to get slaves. We went to Africa and enslaved people. So the language that we use is missing, how we talk about it, how we, I think we separate the humanity from the people we enslaved, you know, in the way we talk about them so that we can justify the enslavement. And that's what, for me, is missing, is really looking at it truthfully. And if we look at it truthfully, we have to engage in that American dialogue that, yeah, we're not equal justice for all. We enslaved people and what that meant. And we have to look at the brutality of slavery because we want to, I know it has to be age appropriate, but just ignoring it doesn't make it go away.
Why is it important, as Nikita told us, to tell children, even young children, that these founding fathers who set up this country, who we all sort of revere, that many of them were slave owners? Why is that important to know?
Because we live through the mythology that these men were without faults, right? They were superhuman. They were so, I mean, George Washington couldn't tell a lie, right? He didn't, you know, he told that he chopped down the cherry tree, which is all not even based on truth, right? Somebody wrote that in his biography. So once we start looking at the complexity, even of our founding fathers, we're looking at the truth. And we can see them for human, the human that they were. And in humanizing them, we can humanize the enslaved. We can humanize each other. So we have to look at that and stop putting these people on these pedestals without really looking at the complexities of who they were as human.
And since you mentioned George Washington, we just have to mention there's a special connection to New Hampshire, right, with George Washington and enslavement of people.
Absolutely. One of his enslaved people, Martha and George's enslaved body servant, Ona Judd, escapes here to Portsmouth from what was the White House in Philadelphia. And ends up living here, and he actually, and this is the complexity of George Washington, he actually sends slave catches for her, right? So on one hand, he's talking gradual emancipation, and on the other hand, he had to get his property back in the form of Ona Judd.
We asked our listeners how they were taught about slavery in school, what they find is lacking. And I want to remind people that you can join us with an email exchange at nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Nikita and Gerianne, we got this great email from Laura yesterday. She answered our question, how were you taught about slavery in school? Laura says, I'm 47 and I still have my high school American history book, which was published in 1986. So I pulled it out, Laura says, and took a look. Laura, by the way, thank you for doing that. She says, the book is over 1,000 pages and slavery is covered in about 7 of those pages, much of which describes plantation owners' extravagant homes and not slavery at all. To quote from the book, Laura says, slaves found many ways to harass their masters. Often they purposely slowed down their work or did it poorly. Sometimes they struck back or even killed their white masters. It also says many slaves, quote, became deceitful and showed respect to their masters while secretly holding resentment and hatred toward white people. Laura gives us one more quote from this book. She says, the book finally reassures, in quotes, with black slaves also found ways of expressing their joy in songs and dances and humor, in folktales and jokes. And the book tells us that many slaves became skilled workers, women learned to spin, weave and sew, and men became blacksmiths, painters, and shoemakers. Laura says the book makes slaves sound like ungrateful foreign exchange students who learned valuable skills and had little appreciation for their, quote, hosts. Appalling, she says. Laura, thank you for doing that work. And Nikita, does this sound like some of the commentary that you got when you talked to people about how they learned about slavery?
Oh, definitely. You know, it's all about the language that is in these textbooks. And it started very early with the textbooks. You know, in doing research for the essay, I went to the Historical Society in New York, and I looked at several books, one of which was a very, you know, small children's book. It almost looked like when I opened it, it was going to be a picture book. It was the Geographical Reader for Dixie Children. And I opened it, and I couldn't believe what I was reading because the geography was based on racism and just casually referred to people from Africa as African savages, said that they were ignorant in their country, but here they had grown docile. So basically there was nothing to worry about. It was shocking, but I realized that, you know, this is an early book from the 1800s. And so, you know, how do you the textbooks take a lot of time to evolve. Remember that a lot of schools are, you know, still have, you know, textbooks from, you know, they're 20 years old. And so even if someone is writing new editions, that language is still there. And that's where we are. It's about the language. It's gotten to the point that many teachers are taking education, if you will, into their own hands, meaning they're not using the textbooks or using the textbooks sparingly or even challenging the textbooks. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center looked at several textbooks for a study 2 years ago. And, you know, what they found was, you know, for example, I looked at the textbook that I used when I was a child, when I was in high school. And my textbook was The American Pageant. And that was the book that was used for the AP history exam. And when you read current editions, it's still referring to the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings as intimate, and it was an affair. And also not referring to the rape of enslaved women as, in fact, rape.
Saying they had relationships, making it sound like they were girlfriend and boyfriend.
Yes.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned AP history because our producer, Christina Phillips, reached out to many teachers for this program. Obviously, 9 o'clock is a hard time for teachers to come on the air, but she did an interview with Bob Ward, who's been teaching history in New Hampshire for 47 years. Right now, he's just teaching AP U.S. history. He's at Goffstown High School. And I want to play this audio from Bob because of something you just said, Nikita, that some teachers do recognize the limitations of textbooks. They're going outside the textbooks. They're putting their own knowledge into this subject area. Here's what Bob said about how much latitude he has in the AP history curriculum.
We've got a broad outline from the College Board of what the course would be, but they also leave us a wide latitude to choose our own examples to represent the various trends in history. Almost everything we teach in history has current relevancy, whether we're talking about race, talking about impeachment, talking about immigration. Almost any topic needs historical context to be understood. And the reality is, I think the trend in current U.S. history is to make sure that all of these topics are integrated into the overall flow of United States history. Slavery and race are not a separate topic. They're right within the flow of the mainstream of history, and we need to deal with them in that fashion.
And that gets to what you said earlier, Geri-Ann, that it isn't just, again, this isolated time period right around the Civil War and so forth. It's woven into everything.
It is. It is. And what he just mentioned is really important, I think. If we have our textbooks that the teachers are using and it's got this, it still has the stereotypical imaging of what it means to be black or be African American, and you're still using those words, we're still reinforcing those ideas. So we need to really train our teachers that they know what the history is, that they can look at, you know, look at their own internal biases, and you know, when there's certain words, you know, we've got to come to this from a real clean slate and look at the words we're using, the stories we're telling, where is these stereotypes coming from, you know, what is the, you know, what is the economic engine that drove the slave trade? You know, why do we focus on the slave owner and not on that whole economic engine? You know, the North is not free from it. We had all the manufacturing for the cotton. We had our plantations. Owners of the same manufacturing place here in New Hampshire owned plantations in the South. So it's not a North or South issue. It's an American issue that we have to look at, and we have to look at it from the whole holistic point of view.
Yeah, we here in the North often think, well, we're off the hook.
Yeah.
But you're saying, uh-uh.
No.
You know, going back to Bob Ward for a moment, again, to bring that New Hampshire teacher voice in, he says he and other teachers have talked about this, and they do feel that slavery should be presented as a factor throughout the history, not just as a Southern thing, not just as a Civil War thing. Let's hear a little bit again from Bob Ward.
I think we're all in agreement that these topics are so much a part of the flow of events in this country. They've done so much to shape the current dialogue in the country that they have to be a part of your curriculum. And while they're not separated off, is slavery relevant to what happens after the Civil War? Absolutely. We have a period of great gain and great loss that follows the Civil War. Is it relevant to what happens in the 1930s during the Depression? Absolutely. Is it relevant to the race issues of the 50s and 60s? Definitely. And do we still have a problem with race in America? Absolutely. And these things are a continuity. And when we look at history, we have to look at both the continuities and the change in history that are shaping the present.
Again, that's Bob Ward. He teaches AP History at Goffstown High School. Nikita, I'd love your thoughts on what you heard from teachers as you worked on this 1619 project, what they felt was adequate, where they wanted, you know, more help in presenting this topic.
Well, you know, with the Southern Poverty Law Center study, they surveyed about 1,700 teachers, and they found that 60% of them did not feel that their textbooks were adequate. So a lot of teachers are looking for guidance. Unfortunately, there are some teachers, you know, every year we hear at least one story that goes national about a teacher deciding to do like a reenactment to engage the students, which is definitely ill-advised. But you have to question why a teacher would decide like, this is okay. And that is because there is no uniform social studies curriculum the way there is for, like, you know, math and reading. In fact, when you look at social studies teachers, most of them also are the athletics coaches, which is interesting.
Well, we'll pick up on the curriculum issue after a short break. I'm really glad you mentioned that, Nikita. I spent a lot of time yesterday looking at New Hampshire's social studies curriculum. So we'll definitely talk about that in just a moment. And let's hear from you. We got some great emails before the show. People answering the question, how were you taught about slavery in school? What did you learn inside the classroom? What did you learn outside the classroom? We also heard from more teachers about how they try to present this topic. So you can comment on Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how do we teach slavery in school? And is it good enough? What's lacking? Listeners, we want to hear from you. What was your experience learning about slavery in school? How did you learn inside the classroom? What did you learn outside the classroom? We'd love to hear from you this morning. Send your email to exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Gerri-Ann Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire and Director of the Harriet Wilson Project. Joining us from New York City, Nikita Stewart. She's a reporter for the New York Times. She wrote, "Why Can't We Teach Slavery Right in American Schools?" for the 1619 Project with the Times. Again, the 1619 Project is a very large reporting project about slavery in America 400 years after it began. There are links and more information to all of this on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And both of you, as we asked our listeners how they learned about slavery in school, I'd like to just share a couple comments that came in last night and this morning. Lanine says, "Didn't learn very much, kind of glossed over. Got a lot more information from Roots, the miniseries, and Eyes on the Prize from PBS in the 80s, also the Civil War documentary from Ken Burns and I'll Fly Away in the 90s. Jane also says, "Watching Roots, a series on PBS TV when I was young, it was so eye-opening for me." And Keith says, "I was in seventh grade when the Roots miniseries came out. From that point on, I don't recall what I was taught in history classes having a major influence in my understanding. In both 8th grade and 10th grade, the years American history was taught in New Hampshire, the focus was much more on the colonial and revolutionary periods than the Civil War, and everything seemed rushed to fit in." Thank you to those listeners for commenting on Facebook, for answering our question, "How did you learn about history in school?" You know, both of you, Nikita, maybe you first. I'm struck by three listeners talking about Roots, and a couple of them mentioned other documentaries. And that's where they really kind of got the appreciation, not in school. I just wonder what you think about that.
I think that's very true. I think about my own upbringing. And one of the things that I had written that didn't make it into the essay was, you know, I can remember like walking in and basically the folks in my family, any household you went into, there was like the Bible and there was a copy of Roots. And I can remember my aunt's was like, you know, she had, you know, read it so often that, you know, the pages were, you know, kind of crumbling and it, you know, was a paperback. And so it's actually a shame that this is a book that a lot of us read outside of a school. But I do remember when I was in the eighth grade, a teacher showed us the Roots series to basically teach enslavement, which looking back, that probably wasn't the way to go either. But she probably didn't have the textbook that she felt was reliable, and she wanted students to understand the cruelty.
Why do you think that wasn't the way to go, Nikita?
Because I think we have to have other documents.
Other
unfortunately,
narratives.
Because
yeah.
Yes, unfortunately, because the written word is so valued, and because we were left out of the written word so many years ago, at the beginning of this country and before, that our stories aren't fully told, but. For example, my great-grandfather was interviewed for the Federal Writers Project, and he was born in 1858 and remembered his enslavement and the enslavement of his mother and his grandmother. And, you know, I would hope that teachers would look to some of those primary sources and allow students to look at those documents and to kind of make some decisions that are about the history of this country that are not necessarily shaped by the opinions of the writer of a textbook.
You know, when you talk about primary sources and documents, Gerianne, that fits in perfectly with what you are doing, both with the Black Heritage Trail in New Hampshire and the Harriet Wilson Project. How much do you see teachers nowadays availing themselves of the resources that you have?
So the few teachers that are really dedicated to this will come and ask, and how, you know, they will find the sources. They will go the extra mile to look for this, because these sources are not really ready. You know, there's not a lot of primary sources that we can look at that will give you the insight into the life of an enslaved person, especially here in the North. So we rely on looking at a broader spectrum and getting and comparing different people's story from different places that would be similar to. So we have to. One of the things that Nikita just said is that, you know, we have to look back at the older records, the oral stories, you know, that the enslaved people told themselves. We have to look back at, you know, people doing their genealogy research. You know, they're different. There's going to be different primary sources simply because the people who get to tell the story here, we're telling it from the white perspective, you know? So it's skewed. The history is skewed from that. I wanted to say, like, I'm originally from Jamaica, so the way we get our stories is told from a total different lens. Our revolutionary fighters, our rebels, were the heroes in this story. So they're courageous. They're brave, you know. They're strategic. They're planning. They're orators, you know. All the other side that would encourage these rebellions and fighting for freedom. So our narratives and our stories are the opposite, because we got to write our stories. And here, somebody else writes our stories.
That's what's interesting about your own personal experience, yeah. Is coming from Jamaica, as you said, you got to write your own stories. And then you come to this country where most enslaved people could not read or write. They were certainly not allowed to. So it's different.
Yeah, I'm always cautious about saying most were not, because when we start looking at documents like the 1779 petition that was written in Portsmouth by 20 enslaved men.
Yes, tell us about that. That's really interesting.
So that really changes that narrative. So in 1779, a group of enslaved men who came to the country, who were enslaved here, they were young boys, got together and wrote this petition for their freedom, just as at the same time that America was writing its Declaration of Independence from the British. So we have the same language, we have the thoughtfulness, we have the humanness in that document that we're looking for, that was written by the men themselves, right? So it gives us a different look. Harriet Wilson's book, published in 1859, changes that literary timeline of when African Americans were writing, and that's one that we know of. That was published. What about other journals that were not published, other writings, you know? And were other people writing in their own home language, right? We don't know. But that just because we don't have it doesn't mean that they weren't. One of the stories that I'm always intrigued by in Portsmouth is the story of Primus Fowler, who would set the types for he was enslaved to Mr. Fowler, and he was the typesetter for the newspaper. And the narrative that comes down about him was that he's illiterate. So how are you illiterate when all your life you're typesetting the paper print? You know, if you're a thinking human being, you just wonder, that raises a question. Well, was he illiterate? How could he set it if he was, you know? So I think our history bears re-examining, And we have to be willing and open to ask the questions and look at those narratives that were written and say, how come? I mean, the idea of a lazy enslaved person not working in the field always blows my mind. While the owner sat down and watched them, they're in the field and expected to produce, right, all of this. But also, too, if they didn't, that's one way they could slow. And they had to be strategic about slowing down work. That one way to protest. You know, they couldn't protest too far because they will be punished. They can't overproduce, so they have to be strategic enough to walk in that middle lane that will get attention, but not the kind of attention that they want.
You know, I want to return for a moment to something Keith wrote us on Facebook. At the end of his comment, Keith says, the focus is much more on the colonial and revolutionary periods than the Civil War, and everything after seemed rushed to fit in. And boy, that's a common refrain that you hear from history teachers is that, yes, I would like to focus more on this, but boy, I am expected to fit so much in. I want to play a little bit more from Bob Ward. Again, that's the AP history teacher who we talked to at Goffstown High. He is, you know, as we heard from him earlier, very involved in presenting this history to his students, in weaving it into our past, our present, our future. But even Bob talked about, you know, the time pressure. So let's hear.
Certainly, the AP curriculum is comprehensive in that we're a survey course, and we basically start with the Beringian land bridge and finish with the Donald Trump administration. And we do this in about 80 class periods of 90 minutes, in my experience. So how do you do it? How do you fit everything in? Well, the key answer, I guess, is that you don't. That you have to pick and choose where you're going to devote your time and have to pre-plan all of that to make sure that you're including all elements of society within your treatment of U.S. history.
So, Jerianne and Nikita, you first, we've been talking sort of big picture and broad, bringing it down to that sort of granular classroom level. What would you say, Nikita, to a history teacher who is completely on board with what you're trying to do with the 1619 Project, but just feels like he or she does not have time? What would you say, Nikita?
Because it is about weaving in the history of enslavement throughout the course, because there is nothing that has happened in this country that has not been touched by this country's decision.
I've had moments in
Sorry about that. Go ahead, Nikita.
Yeah, there's nothing that has not been touched. Our banking system, the way we farm, the way we, you can bring it to the modern era, our mass incarceration, redlining, our electoral college. These are all subjects that are taught where you can also remember to go back and explain how enslavement influenced these modern forms of discrimination, or these modern, the way we operate our government. And there's always a teaching moment, right? Because I was thinking about the language that we use. And, you know, you saw so many people comment when the term lynching was used this week. And so that was a chance to give a history lesson on lynching in this country.
Let's go to our listeners again. And I love the comments that have been coming in. You can post on Facebook. You can send us an email. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And to the phones now, Elizabeth's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was just wondering, hi. Well, she kind of already answered my question as far as like raising the issue regarding the L word, which was just used by our president and has been used by people throughout history to describe their own personal political plight all the way to the Coos County Democratic chair. So why is it that white people feel emboldened to use the word lynching to describe their own situation, and yet they have absolutely no idea, it seems, that what that word is rooted in, and that is a terrible history that we are trying to overcome.
Elizabeth, thank you for the call. Jerrianne, I'd love your thoughts on this.
I had to pause on that one because the majority of people, we erase this history so well, we don't want to talk about it, that it becomes another word, another word that we could use, you know, like how we normalize things. If you say it enough, then it's normalized, and it has no grounding in history. It's one of those things that blows my mind, because if we look at the whole history, the history of lynching in the country, and that even, you know, it's just horrible. And I don't think Americans really want to face that history of how brutal and how torturous, degrading, dehuman. I mean, if you look at the pictures, you know, of people celebrating over a burnt corpse, then that's not, in your heart, you say, that's not America, so we wipe it out, you know, because we want to say America, equal justice for all, land of the free, home of the brave, and all the platitudes we say. But looking at our history in its true form, really facing it, requires us to, and I think if we understood that, you know, what that did, and that trauma that still carries on today, that historical trauma, then we would have a better understanding of how we use it. Because that, the use of it is just to create this sensationalized feeling, you know, oh, I'm being lynched, with no concept of all the other deep psychological traumatic experiences that other people, and we have people, I mean, Nikita is talking about her great-grandparents living through enslavement, right? It's not that far away, that history, that historical memory shouldn't be that far away, that we can blatantly use a word like that as a throwaway word to get attention.
So don't use it.
No.
Unless you're talking about history and the real thing.
We're talking about what it is. We're talking that it has that meaning. We're talking about people's lives. We're talking about just really torture, you know? We don't talk about, I mean, our Jewish community went through the ovens, right? We don't use that as a blatant thing that we go out and say, right? Because we know what it means. We know that pain. We know that trauma. We know the families. We know the survivors. We know the people are still there. So it's to honor and understand that history.
Well, thank you for the call, Elizabeth. And I think it gets to something that you both have talked about, that Bob Ward, the teacher who we interviewed, talks about, sort of learning about this, but not just in that isolated context of the Civil War era, but really weaving it into, again, America's past and present and future. So thank you for the call. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can catch up on all the New Hampshire news that you might have missed during the week. That's tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, how we teach slavery in schools and what's missing. The phone number for you to join us is 1-800-848-9222. 8926477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Gerry Ann Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire, Director of the Harriet Wilson Project, and joining us from New York, Nikita Stewart, a reporter for the New York Times. She wrote recently, "Why Can't We Teach Slavery Right in American Schools?" for the 1619 Project. If you're not familiar with that, that's a project of the New York Times about slavery in America 400 years after it began. And you can check out our website today for more information and links. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And Gerry Ann and Nikita, lots of responses from our listeners. I'd like to share an email that was written in by Barry in Concord. He says, "As an Afro-American parent whose children have been educated in New Hampshire, I'm deeply concerned about the lack of racial diversity of New Hampshire teachers and it's the impact on the ability to pass deeper understanding of the impact of slavery." Barry says, "Recall that the spokesman of the New Hampshire Department of Education submitted a racially and ethnically charged trope in the comment section of the local paper." This is just to let listeners know if they weren't familiar. A former Department of Education official said New Hampshire had become a cesspool in comments in a New York Times article about our state's efforts to promote diversity. Barry says, "My eighth grade son came home and said he was given pieces of seeded cotton to demonstrate the difficulty of separating the seeds as their demonstration of the difficulty of slavery. What is the larger plan for education on this and similar topics in New Hampshire? Recall, slavery in America is 400 years, 150 years older than the Republic, but gets just a few hours in a child's education." Thank you so much, Barry. And I want to hear from both of you on this. Maybe you first, Nikita, especially around his example of that exercise that his son got, separating seeds out of cotton, to show you how hard it was.
Yes, that is not the first time I have heard that. For some reason, teachers think that is a good way. But when you have reenactments like that and tasks, it trivializes the cruelty, the brutality of what happened in this country. When he talked about diversity, the lack of diversity in New Hampshire, New Hampshire is not alone. 80% of teachers in this country, and there are like more than 3 million teachers, are white. And that is not to say that white people can't teach black history or history of any other people other than white people. But it is to say that there is there's this lack of diverse voices in education, period, throughout this country. And until we have everyone at the table trying to collectively shape what our children learn, we're going to be having this conversation for a long time.
Well, and people sent in examples after you wrote your essay, Nikita, or maybe as a part of it, sharing how they were taught about slavery. I want to share one. Got this from, again, from the 1619 Project. Mary wrote in the fifth grade, I was one of three black girls in the class, and all three of us were assigned to be, quote, slaves during a presentation. I told my teacher that I was too nervous to give the presentation, and he told me to add that into the role-playing. He said, if my voice shakes or cracks, I can say I sound like that because, quote, Massa will beat me or sell me if he knew I was talking to y'alls, end quote. It was very humiliating, Mary says, and I felt horrible afterwards. And you know what strikes me about this story? It wouldn't be so surprising if this person who wrote in were, you know, 70, 60 years old. Mary, who wrote in, is 29. So she wasn't in high school that long ago. I wonder what your response is either to that, Gerry Ann, or to some of the themes that were raised by Ben, who emailed us.
So in talking to Ben, who emailed, our educational system is another system that falls in that systemic racial issues of problems, where if we, our AP teacher that we just spoke on, even here in New Hampshire, really here, the amount of the students of color who are in AP classes. They just don't get into AP classes, and not because of their abilities that they can't. So we notice in our educational system that up to middle school, all students test at the same level. No matter race, color, class, they're all testing, you know, in their abilities in their group at the same. When they get to middle school, we start seeing that breakdown by race. And what happens in our early learning classes to when they get to middle school? What is our system doing? Where are we getting these ideas that students of color are not as bright? And then if we start coming to high school and then we start, you know, separating our students and saying that this group of people are not bright enough to do AP classes, then it goes to college, and then it goes to the on and on. So how do we create those equal educational systems where we're not looking at people through a racialized lens?
We actually reached out again to our audience well before the show, asking how people were taught about slavery, what more they want to know. And we did get a voicemail from a student in Manchester. So let's hear from her.
Hi, my name is Haiba Hassan, and I'm a junior at Manchester Central High School. At school, we don't really talk about race as a topic. We really just hang with people with similar interests and similar cultures. And in the classroom, it'd be cool if we actually could learn about more African countries and diverse culture, and what things were like before slavery.
And I want to thank her for calling in. And I'm so struck by the last thing that she said, both of you. She says, I'm interested in, you know, where people came from, what their cultures were like before slavery. And Nikita, we never learn about that part in U.S. history. We learn when it came to our shores, or at least I certainly don't remember anything, you know, before 1619. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that wonderful call we got from the student in Manchester.
I would say she's absolutely right. I certainly did not learn anything other than what I saw in Roots and what I read in Roots. And then when I got to college, then my eyes were open to different books that I could read. Before we were forced to come to this country. And so I think she's absolutely right on that. And I wanted to go back to what Jerianne was talking about. She asked, where did we get these ideas, basically, that Black children are inferior, and it all goes back to enslavement. The justification for enslavement was that Black people were inferior. Black people didn't have feelings. Black people could take pain. They did not feel pain. And these lies, you know, people are still holding onto them today, and that's how we are still seeing the discrimination that we're seeing and the segregation. New York City has one of the most segregated school systems in the country, and you know, it's often blamed on our basically money, economics. So, you know, you're in this neighborhood and it happens to be mostly Black and Hispanic, so those are the folks at your school, but that doesn't explain, the specialized high schools, and it doesn't explain when, all over the country, when white parents simply believe that if there are too many Black students in the school, then the school must be bad.
Well, we've been hearing from listeners, and I've been sharing their comments throughout the hour, and it's been so interesting to hear from people about how they learned about slavery. We also heard from several teachers, in addition to Bob Ward, whose interview we've been playing. Derek wrote, "For those who teach Latin and ancient history, you start with the slave societies of the Near East, Greece, and Rome, the similarities and differences between them, the ideologies underpinning them. You explain the freedmen system of Rome, plus the different ways field slaves were treated versus house slaves, and the different ways women slaves were treated and so forth. So that's Derek. He's a teacher. He wrote in. Sherry says, I start at the beginning, 1619. I move on to the distinction drawn in the John Punch case between white indentured servants and black slaves, then cover their Virginia slave codes. Sherry says, students need to understand the careful and deliberate building of a brutal system. So I just want to share those comments from New Hampshire teachers. And let's go to the phones. Ron is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Ron. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning, Laura. I just want to congratulate Ms. Stewart in the New York Times on the 1619 series. It's wonderful, and the podcast is extremely illuminating and obviously also quite disturbing. I grew up and graduated high school in the 80s, had a standard public education, didn't learn much about slavery or enslavement, and then discovered Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States, on my own. And it just feels like there should be more scholarship from the perspective of people. We, you know the old aphorism that history is written by the winners, but in order to understand where we are, and we're seeing the dire consequences of our own collective historical ignorance right now in many ways, we need to dig deeper and figure out how to bring these individual stories and these plights to our attention so we understand how we got here and what we need to do to fix some of these historical wrongs as much as we possibly can.
Well, Ron, thank you very much for calling. And a couple listeners, I want to let you know, Nikita also mentioned the 1619 Project. Robbie wrote, he didn't learn nearly enough about slavery, that's for sure. He says the 1619 Project is a real eye-opener. What do you hope to do with this project, Nikita? I know you're just one person working on it, but what's sort of the span of your aspirations with this?
Well, there is already a curriculum on, using the 1619 Project. The Pulitzer Center has been instrumental in being a partner with the New York Times in providing teachers with the information from the 1619 Project, and also offers questions that can be asked to students. The 1619 Project certainly did not end with the printing of a special section and the magazine. We want this to live on, and I think what has been most valuable about the 1619 Project, which was headed by my dear friend, Nicole Hannah Jones, is that it sparked a conversation that people were not expecting to have to engage in. And that has been just beautiful to watch. And I think it also sparks this... it's actually a very American thing, right? To be able to stand up and challenge what is happening and what we learned. And I just think it's fantastic.
Go ahead, Jerianne. Your work in terms of students, whether working with teachers or just individual young people.
Well, what Nikita said is what really excites me. This work sparks a conversation. And that's what... I mean, that's why we do what we do, is to get that dialogue going. The African Burying Ground in Portsmouth, people can't go there now and not raise that question. Why is this monument here? What is this history? There was slavery in the North. How did they get here? Who are these? So it sparks that conversation. Looking as we extend statewide and tell the different stories of Harriet Wilson in Milford, if we tell Noyes Academy in Canaan, if we tell about Amos Fortune, they're African American people, black people, formerly enslaved people all across the state, that you can tell, right in somebody's hometown. And it raises right in your backyard. So it raises the question, and then you can start that dialogue. It's an easy place to get into the conversation when you're talking about somebody, someone, history right in your backyard.
A place you either live in or drive by or visit frequently.
That you know.
Well, and to that point, Mike in New Hampton writes, the Underground Railroad had several routes through New Hampshire. Rogers Homestead, now Silver Hall at Plymouth State, he says. Polar Caves in Rumney were a hideout. The first integrated school in Canaan, which you just mentioned, Jerry Ann, and the runaway slave of George Washington escaped to Portsmouth. And he's referring to Ona Judge, who you mentioned earlier. As we close out, I want to play one more from AP U.S. history teacher Bob Ward, where we asked him, you know, what surprises you about what people don't know? He responded by saying, okay, there's always a lot more to learn. But he feels young people's understanding today is a little bit better. Let's hear.
I think there's a constant feeling that there isn't enough knowledge out there, but I think that's being remedied over time. If you had asked the average student 10 years ago what the significance of the date 1619 was, I doubt that very many people would know. But I think today it's become simply a part of our telling the story of America. And can I throw in a praise for the 1619 Project, which is making so much material readily available to teachers and students that it's really a fantastic thing to be doing.
And so there you have it, Nikita.
Ending.
Thank you, Bob. Well, and I want to let everybody know that there is a link on our website to that project. And boy, there's so much more that we could have talked about. And I had a lot more comments from listeners that I didn't have time to share. But it shows, I think, that people are interested in learning about this and in talking about it. Nikita Stewart, thank you very much for your time. I know you're very busy. We really appreciate you coming on with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the discussion.
That's Nikita Stewart, reporter for the New York Times. She wrote, Why Can't We Teach Slavery Right in American Schools? For the 1619 Project. And Jerry Ann Bogus, always nice to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Laura.
It's Jerry Ann Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire and Director of the Harriet Wilson Project. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kinoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.